Now, counsel, we're calling the case of Constable v. Northglenn. Please enter your appearance, your name, and who you represent. Of course, thank you.
Casey Quillen, representing Carroll Constable.
Okay, go ahead, present your argument.
Sorry.
Yep.
Good morning, may it please the court, as I said, my name is Casey Quillen, and I am representing Carroll Constable, who at the time of the accident at issue was doing business as Flowers and Roses, a floral shop. It's my honor to be arguing my first case before this in court, and I hope to do my client justice despite my nerves and a frog in my throat from a cold I've had. In December, 6 years ago, Edith Wallace pulled into the parking lot of the Washington Center, stepped out of her car to visit Carroll Constable's floral shop. And as she was crossing the parking lot, she slipped on ice that had accumulated because of drainage in that parking lot. Ms. Wallace brought suit against the owner of the shopping center, Northglenn, and also the property manager, Jaylong Incorporated. Several months later, Northglenn then sued Carroll Constable for indemnification. Northglenn shortly thereafter settled with Ms. Wallace, and this matter proceeded on Ms. Constable's motion for determination of law. The trial court agreed that the indemnification agreement between Northglenn and Carroll Constable was unenforceable. The Court of Appeals disagreed, and here we are today. A landlord-tenant lease agreement that contractually requires a tenant to indemnify the landlord for the landlord's own fault in failing to maintain common areas should be void as against public policy because it circumvents the non-delegable duty of the landowner under the Premises Liability Act. The argument is simple. It's an axiom of Colorado law that statutory provisions cannot be modified by private contractual agreements if doing so would violate the public policy expressed in the statute. Section 13.
Well, let me ask you, Joe, the indemnification agreement, still it would hold the landlord responsible, but if the landlord is found to be liable for judgment, then would collect the amount back from the tenant, right? I mean, this doesn't forgive the liability, right? It's an arrangement between parties based on contract to adjust the amounts owed, isn't it?
It is an arrangement between parties to adjust the amounts owed, but I think, unfortunately, financial consequences often serve as the only incentive to meet a duty in today's world, even in the face of a non-delegable duty. And the Premises Liability Act was enacted primarily to promote responsibility of landowners and also afford protections to visitors on the premises according to their status as determined by the court. In this case, we have a landowner contracting with its invitee essentially to agree that any fault of the landowner is going to be the financial responsibility ultimately of the invitee.
Could I ask you a question, please? The Court of Appeals opinion seems to suggest that this indemnification agreement provided your client with an additional avenue of collection.
As I read the Court of Appeals opinion, I understood their interpretation to mean that the plaintiff, Ms. Wallace, who was the injured party in this case, would have somehow an additional avenue of compensation because of this indemnification agreement between Northglenn, the landowner, and Carroll Constable, the tenant of the floral shop. I frankly did not understand that reasoning and think that if that is allowed to stand, it could certainly create a lot of confusion as far as, you know, in the law of this case once we proceed to trial, as well as down the road.
It's clear that by virtue of the indemnification agreement, the position that the party, the North Glenn is taking is that it is indemnified. It is not jointly and severally liable. It is just simply not liable at all for any damages. There might be a duty and a breach, but not any liability for damages. So there's nothing, if I'm understanding the facts correctly, additional about this source.
Correct.
That just seems to be a misstatement in the Court of Appeals.
That is how I read it, Your Honor.
It's not a second source of collection.
Okay. Right.
Well, it's additional in the sense it's a backup source, right?
It's additional in the sense that the landowner will, in the end, be reimbursed for everything that it has paid to the injured party in this.
Oh, it's an additional source for the injured party. The injured party has two potential sources. In the event there are financial difficulties with Glenn, there are two potential sources to pay the directly or indirectly to pay the injured party. Isn't that correct?
I presume you're talking about if the for some reason North Glenn was unable to pay, then perhaps if Ms. Wallace was determined to be a third-party beneficiary of the indemnification clause, she could pursue her claims directly against Carol Constable and be...
Oh, not even that. I mean, we're talking about economic consequences. I'm not really talking about, I think, the legal aspects of that. It seems to me the economic consequences are she can pursue her claims, and there are two pockets of money that ultimately... one or the other might be capped directly or indirectly. Isn't that right?
To the extent that there are two pockets of money that could ultimately provide her the same amount of damages, I think, if I'm understanding your argument, Your Honor, yes, that is correct.
What are the two? What are the two
pockets? Source, as in, she can receive money from North Glenn, and then if that
doesn't increase her recovery in any way,
she can receive additional money from. Well,
yeah, that was exactly my question. And what are the two pockets given the indemnification agreement for recovery, not for liability?
For recovery directly from by Ms. Wallace, the injured party. Well, in this case, she sued North Glenn. They settled with her, and she did not pursue any claims against Ms. Constable directly. I don't think that she could have, frankly, and there is not another pocket available directly to Ms. Wallace. It is North Glenn that essentially has another purse in another room that will, refill its pockets once it has paid out that money to Ms. Wallace.
Counsel, can I just follow up on that? I guess I want you to focus, though, on the nature of the non... I guess your argument is this is non-delegable, so therefore you can have no indemnification, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and let me just follow up on that. Isn't it the case that if the injured party sued North Glenn and North Glenn settled... And then North Glenn, so North Glenn liability-wise is on the hook, isn't it? In that nature? I mean, that's exactly what happened here in terms of North Glenn, well, they settled, but if they had gone to trial, North Glenn would have been deemed liable. Isn't that correct?
Yes, but I think that the principal problem with such an indemnification clause is that it fosters an environment where the landowner is not financially responsible for maintaining.
And let me just follow up on that, though. Let's imagine that this did go to trial and North Glenn was deemed liable. And then North Glenn seeks indemnification from your client. Let's say your client is judgment proof and has no funds, correct? So isn't that risk creating some sort of incentive to take care for North Glenn?
I think it may be, but I don't know that in light of the strong public policy issues that risk is enough. I think an analogy can be drawn to the construction industry, and the General Assembly has recognized that businesses have a non-delegable responsibility to assume their own negligence and be responsible for their own negligence. And so in 1321 111.5 subsection 6, the General Assembly has now plainly stated that businesses have that non-delegable duty, and to that end, indemnification agreements that seek to overreach and impose financial responsibility on other parties beyond their own negligence are void as against public policy. Going back to this case, I think the key issue is that what we have is a landowner and an invitee. I think it's more poignant if you consider what would have happened if it was the invitee, Ms. Constable, who had slipped and fell in the parking lot. She would be left with no recourse against anyone for failure to maintain the common area. We're not asking for a very broad ruling that indemnification agreements with landlords and tenants, period, are void and unenforceable. But I think because this accident occurred in a common area where Ms. Constable and all of the other tenants in the Washington Center shopping center had absolutely no right of control and absolutely no ability to take any remedial measures to prevent this kind of accident, remove snow and ice, et cetera, then we're left with a situation where the public in general is not being protected to the full extent that was intended by the Premises Liability Act.
It seems to me the premise that they're not being protected to the full extent is again based on the economic assessment that the risk to the landowner is not sufficient to create a proper incentive for them to fulfill their non-delegable duty. Correct?
Correct.
I have a little bit of difficulty with the court being the one to assess whether that's sufficient economic consequence. Legislature is differently postured, of course, to do that. But it seems to me that we would need to take into account a number of things. And I'm kind of thinking of what's your response to the argument that this is not, you know, this is like insurance or something. And it seems to me that what I'm thinking about is, is the incentive Flowers and Roses may not be solvent. Is that sufficient? Is the risk that you may not be able to get tenants with that sort of provision in your lease, is that sufficient? Are the insurance consequences, that is, are they able to get liability insurance more readily, or liability insurance doesn't care about the fact that they're indemnified? I mean, these seem to be all considerations that are very difficult for the court to take into account on a public policy basis.
I do agree that the incentive perspective is a difficult approach for the court to take, but I think as the court has looked on several occasions at the Premises Liability Act and tried to craft a better understanding of how that should be applied here. And in this case, because of the nature of the relationship between the contracting parties and the location where the injury occurred, I don't know that the court needs to get into an analysis of all of these incentives in all different circumstances that might arise in landlord-tenant agreements. I think the central issue is that an invitee should not be asked to indemnify its landlord for injuries, damages, or losses that occur in a common area when that invitee has no control over that area that could prevent an injury, because not only is the invitee left unprotected, the general public is left unprotected, which is clearly in contravention of the intent of the Premises Liability Act to promote landowner responsibility. If there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve my minute for rebuttal.
Well, you'll have about 54 seconds. Thank you.
Hey, please support counsel. Alan Epstein representing North Glen LLC. The issue on which this court granted certiorari is whether a landlord-tenant lease agreement that contractually requires a tenant to indemnify the landlord for the landlord's own negligence is enforceable when the duty breached is non-delegable. The answer to that question is that it is enforceable. An indemnity provision that holds an indemnitor liable for the indemnity's conduct must contain clear and unequivocal language to that effect. This court in Public Service v. United Cable Television held that where the language of an agreement under which the indemnitor agreed to indemnify for the indemnity's own negligence was clear, the agreement was enforceable. The court reasoned that it perceived no reason why commercial contracts entered into by two sophisticated parties following full negotiation should be construed in a manner which frustrates the obvious intent.
Mr. Esten, can I?
Yeah, Justice Royce.
This is what has always confused me about this case. So the woman who was injured fell in the parking lot of the North Glen shopping mall, right?
Yes.
And the only way Flowers and Roses got, and Ms. Constable got involved in it, is that the woman who was injured said, oh, I was going to go to that particular store?
That is what's so weird to me.
I mean, what if she had just said, you know, I'm going to, like, just browse through the mall and check out kind of what's for sale. Then would everybody who in the mall, all of the shops in the mall, have been brought into this lawsuit?
The trial court held that potential made the agreement vague and ambiguous, but potentially you wouldn't, if you didn't know where this patron was going to visit or shop.
It wasn't like she had bought some flowers and roses and was on her way back out into the parking lot. She was just in the parking lot going into this mall.
Right. It's undisputed that that's where she was going. And under these circumstances, as the Court of Appeals stated, that may be a factual issue that would have different ramifications in a different case. But here, there's no dispute that Ms. Wallace was going into this flower shop. And
that's the basis for the liability on Flowers and Roses, this store. That this woman who was hurt in the parking lot said she was going to go to this store.
Yes, under the agreement language, the flower shop was the tenant.
I had much the same question. Was the landlord trying to put the duty on each of these shops to parcel up the parking lot and maintain it? I mean, I don't understand how this works. Who had the duty to maintain the parking lot?
The landlord had the duty under the agreement to hire somebody to come and clear the snow after it snowed, snow and ice after it snowed. The landlord had that duty.
Why isn't it laid back off against all the tenants under the indemnification agreements to share the responsibility? Why does it land on one person based on who gets out of the car and goes to a particular shop and may intend, in fact, to go to others as well?
Arguably it could, but the way the language of the indemnity agreement reads, the tenant the language of the agreement means that the tenant is the tenant into which shop the patron is going. That's how the language of the agreement reads.
Well, it actually says if present in order to visit the premises. So I don't know what the premises are, but the premises seems to be the mall, and you all, I guess somehow along the line, the premises got converted into the store, Flowers and Roses.
I think that's...
But that's not necessarily what the lease says. I mean, I don't think. If present to go to the premises.
Well, premises, the term premises read in conjunction with the term tenant, I think clearly means whichever establishment the patron is visiting. And that's what the Court of Appeals held. And that's why the Court of Appeals held that the meaning of that phraseology is unambiguous or fact-driven depending upon the facts of a particular case. And in this case, it's not disputed that the...
What do you think would happen, I mean, just hypothetically, if the person who was hurt said, I don't know, I was just going to visit the mall and check out the sales? Whose liability would that be then? Everybody's? Or?
Then it might be everybody's, or it just might be North Glen's. But this is a situation in which the language of the agreement is not ambiguous as applied, if I can borrow from a constitutional law concept.
Well, it sure seems like a sharp agreement to me. I mean, and isn't it to be construed against the drafter?
If it's clear on a well. It must contain clear and unequivocal language to be enforceable.
Right.
It's no more sharp an agreement than the indemnity agreement in the public service case, which contains virtually identical language. It is holding an indemnitor liable for an indemnity's negligence, but that isn't any different than public service. And the language is exactly the
okay. So the negligence here is where did Flowers and Roses have negligent conduct?
Flowers and Roses was not negligent.
Okay.
The landlord was negligent. That's exactly what happened in public service, though. Public service was negligent, but this court held that the language of the indemnity agreement there, which is virtually identical to the language here, permitted public service to recover indemnity from the non-negligent cable television company. And that rationale would apply here, and the fact that the duty is non-delegable is a distinction without a difference, I believe.
Why is that, though? I mean, why isn't the fact that the duty... just help me understand that, because there was no delegable or non-delegable duty in the public service case. Why does that make no difference here?
Because the duty is not delegated to a third party. The North Glen still has the same duty, just as public service had that duty. What occurs is that there's a different financial source from whom North Glen can recover to make it financially whole, just as public service was held financially whole by United Cable. So the fact that the duty is non-delegable is
well, financially whole for its negligence, though. That's the problem with this case and the public policy issue, right? North Glen can just not do anything, let ice build up on this parking lot because they just go collect, find out where the person was going, and bingo, they're...
That's true.
They don't have to hire a snow removal crew.
That's true in every situation in which an indemnity seeks indemnity from for its negligence from an indemnitor. And if that were a concern, I don't see how the court could not affirm this case or could reverse this case without overruling public service, because it's no different. And all of the cases that have addressed the issue from other jurisdictions have held that it does not make a difference that the duty is non-delegable, and analogized to a situation in which somebody driving a car is not going to be negligent just because they have auto insurance. There are other ramifications, and there'd be other ramifications for North Glen here. People wouldn't shop there. Their insurance premiums could go up. So it isn't. It really isn't any different. It makes no practical difference that the duty owed under the premises liability statute is non-delegable. The same rationale that this court articulated in public service applies whether the duty is delegable or non-delegable. My search of cases from other jurisdictions, since this is an issue of first impression here, they universally hold that such an agreement is enforceable, notwithstanding that the duty owed is non-delegable. Petitioner apparently didn't locate any case in which court answered the question posed by this court in the negative. For example, in Dykstra v. Arthur G. McKee and Company, the Wisconsin Supreme Court addressed the issue whether an indemnity agreement which indemnified a wholly negligent general contractor for violation of the Wisconsin Safe Place Statute was contrary to public policy because the general contractor's duty to provide a safe workplace under the statute was non-delegable. And the court rejected the indemnifying subcontractor's argument that the indemnity agreement was unenforceable because it permitted the general to avoid its duties imposed by the Safe Place Statute. The court reasoned that the indemnity agreement did not shift the general's safe place duties.
Stephanie, on the Dykstra case, I guess Ms. Quillen argues that that's distinguishable because the indemnity had various incentives in the contract. I wonder how, if you could address that.
Well, petitioner attempts to distinguish Dykstra because the indemnity agreement there precluded indemnity if the subcontractor had diligently tried to minimize the risk of injury. I think that's the language that's different from this contract.
So why is that?
That was not a factor in the court's reasoning. The court in Dykstra would necessarily have reached the same conclusion if that language had not been in the agreement. In Dykstra, the court held, and this is 301 Northwest 2nd at page 202, the principal question on this review is whether an indemnity contract which purports to indemnify a wholly negligent indemnity for a violation of the Safe Place Statute under circumstances where the indemnitor is totally free of negligence is contrary to public policy. We conclude that such a contract of indemnity is valid. That's the exact same issue in this case, and there's nothing in Dykstra that turned on the fact that there was that distinguishing language.
I have another question. In the in the cable case, Public Service versus United Cable, part of the agreement there that Public Service had with the cable provider was that it carry insurance and that it'd be solvent to cover these kinds of risks and damages. Was there a similar sort of requirement in this lease agreement with North Glen and the shops?
It wasn't in the lease agreement, but I wouldn't be here if there wasn't insurance. it's not contained in the lease agreement itself, but and a lot of agreements do have that kind of.
I'm saying did North Glen require the shops to carry insurance sufficient to cover the losses that anybody would suffer?
I'm sorry.
Did North Glen require? You know, said I'm going to. It said to the shops, I'm going to force you to pay any damages that arise out of these kinds of accidents, but you shops, Flowers and Roses, have to carry insurance sufficient to be able to do so, or else we won't let you lease.
I don't know the answer to that.
And that was one of the factors that the court looked at in the Public Service case. It said, well, you're just basically switching the pocket from which you're going to be getting damages. You're not eliminating a pocket, or at least eliminating the pot, or at least creating the possibility that there might be someone who is on the hook who doesn't have enough insurance coverage to be able to pay damages, right? So isn't that something that would be fairly significant in terms of how we might want to distinguish these cases?
Well, that might be yet a third source.
What's the third source?
Insurance.
I'm asking you whether this is something that would distinguish the policy between these two cases.
I don't think so.
I don't
read Public Service as turning on that factor. It may have been a consideration, but it wasn't the factor on which the court based its decision. I see I'm almost out of time. Unless the court has any further questions, I have nothing additional. Thank you.
Okay.
I think the important distinction between this case and public service and those of other jurisdictions cited by North Glenn is the idea of control and the ability for the indemnity to somehow mitigate or minimize the risk to the public and therefore have some protections of itself for monies it would have.
Yeah, but your client entered into this, didn't have to lease there. They could have gone to some other mall. I mean, it's just a bad deal, right? I mean, but why does it make it void against public policy?
It may not have been prudent for her to lease here, but if this type of agreement is upheld, I'm sure that we will see them across the board for all commercial leases and what is to prevent them from also infiltrating into residential leases and requiring an invitee in that circumstance to indemnify the landowner. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will stand submitted. Thank you for your arguments.